Hey, thanks for joining us this weekend on Nevada Backcountry. Took a week off last week to rerun the Chris Costin episode, and we're actually pre-recording this because we were at the Muley Foundation banquet last night, and so I didn't want to roll the dice and roll in here disheveled and depressed that I didn't win anything. So I figured, hey, let's knock out the show ahead of time so we can just go to the Muley Foundation banquet and enjoy ourselves.
Exactly.
Hopefully last night I won a bunch of stuff, but I guess that remains to be seen. Before we dive into, we'll call it episode 2 of our conservation series we're doing, I want to give a quick shout out to Legacy Sports International, home of the Howa Superlight. Do not let the season roll up on you with a tag in your pocket and you're thinking, oh man, I got to dig through the garage. What rifle am I going to use? Go to any of the retailers in the area. Check out the Howa Superlight series. You will not be disappointed. Without further ado, Dave, let's jump right back into kind of where we left off, but the conservation stuff off air here before we started rolling. Man, Nevada is such a, it's a unique animal, and we keep saying that. But I brought up the point that I'd be willing to bet Nevada per acre is one of the smallest, or Endow is one of the smallest agencies in the country as far as how much land is actually overseen by the agency. What did you say? Rhode Island has more game wardens?
Yeah, something like that. It's, yeah. Rhode Island has more game wardens than Nevada. Yeah, it is. I mean, it is one of the smaller agencies in the country.
Okay.
A lot of the biologists have to cover an enormous amount of land cover, just hundreds of miles. And getting to all of that is, it can be difficult.
Inaccessible terrain.
Some of it is really tough terrain. They do their best. They do a fantastic job. And, you know, it's a challenge. There's a lot of collaboration with federal partners, with NGOs, nonprofits, with universities, helping out with contracting with them for, you know, having a master's or a PhD student come in and do some research in relation to some of our hot topics, you know, if it's big game or small mammals or raptors or, you know, whatever it might be, even habitat restoration or habitat evaluation stuff. So there's a lot of things going on behind the curtain to get a lot of this work done. The biologist individually, there's just absolutely, you know, almost no way that all of that work can be accomplished.
Well, and I know when we had Cody Schroeder on, what he was or is the antelope guy, the elk guy, the deer guy,
yeah,
or whatever.
Deer and antelope. And then, yeah, our other Cody is the moose and elk.
So Everybody wears a lot of hats. There's no specializing. Like, I am the three-toed sloth guy for Nevada or whatever.
No, I mean, the specialties for the big game stuff, you have the bighorn sheep specialist, and, you know, you have some specialties because of the level of importance those particular species have.
Okay.
But other than that, you have a lot of folks that, yes, they wear a lot of hats.
That's definitely a challenge. Where do you want to start on the list of unique conservation aspects in the state of Nevada?
Probably the biggest, the most unique aspect, as we've spoken about previously on our show, is that over 80% of Nevada is federally owned. So there's a lot of restrictions on what can and can't be done on a lot of the land that we're trying to manage for wildlife. Our biggest issue is obviously the feral horses are
right.
Probably one of the bigger issues in a lot of these areas because of our water scarcity and our invasive species. You know, and when I talk about invasive species, I'm talking primarily about plants. You know, you get the cheatgrasses.
Is that the big one?
Thistles. Yeah. I mean, when we have the wildfires come through and, you know, completely just turned a place into Mars, what's going to come back is generally not going to be nice, big Wyoming sage or bitterbrush or something. I mean, that may come back through seeding processes and through a lot of work and effort with, you know, Endow and collaborators. You're going to get cheatgrass and other invasives that are going to come bleeding through there. It's just It's one of those endless battles that will always be there.
Right.
You know, you're always trying to plant some, you know, Indian rice grasses and all these other beneficial plants.
What are the top fenders as far as invasive species? We'll go plants.
for sure you've got the thistles. The number one's probably cheatgrass.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Yeah.
That one doesn't take much at all to get that thing started.
And then just, from cheatgrass, you'd say...
Yeah, I'd say probably some of the thistles.
So all the stuff I look for good chucker habitat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Are the offenders.
Exactly. They're all the offenders. Okay. So that's some of our biggest challenges. A lot of this stuff that there's not a lot of control of, you know, like the water stuff, the invasive plants, the wildfires, to some degree, we can't control that. You've got the, you know, traffic collisions, the fragmentation of habitats in the state. All of these are really playing big part in primarily like our deer herds,
okay,
which are really hitting it hard. That there is definitely the feral horses as well as, you know, mountain lions have
predation stuff. Yeah.
Predation issues.
Go back to the traffic, because the traffic one's interesting to me. Everybody made fun of Harry Reid when they did that big, and I don't know if he was a sponsor. I forget how he was tied in with it, but those like...
The overpasses?
The overpass thing.
Yeah. I mean, those things have been... There's a lot of research on those overpasses. They're all over the Wyoming and several other states. They're underpasses and overpasses.
Right.
And all of those have varying costs associated with them. The underpasses are most cost effective.
Okay.
You know, and then you have your standard overpass and you have your vegetated one. But those things work phenomenal. I mean,
right,
they really, they build the fencing system so they kind of funnel the animals to the overpass or underpass. And it just, for one, a lot less car and wildlife collisions.
Right.
Which suck. You're also, now you've got this ability for this genetic diversity to continue to happen from range to range. Because, you know, when infrastructure happens and you're building a road, you got your engineers out there, they're not going to go, well, let's just go up and over this mountain instead of cruising through
right.
this nice flat
easy
valley.
Corridors and
right.
yeah.
Well, yep. That valley is a wintering ground or a summering ground or, you know, for something like that. And now you're splitting it in half. You're fragmenting their habitat. So it's really cool. And I'd love to see more of those happen in the state.
Well, I was going to point out, because I've heard comments, derogatory comments made about them before. And the issue we have is mule deer are so unique in that they are not going to find a new way. They're not like whitetails.
No.
Now, they might go through an underpass. They'll adapt to that kind of stuff. But you can't have these small isolated pockets of mule deer. They just do not do well. That human-animal interface area, it destroys mule deer herds.
Oh, it wrecks them.
And so that's why you don't see a lot of effort. We'll say, let's take Georgia, for example, right? Like huge whitetail population. There's not a huge push like, hey, we need to build migration. Well, whitetail don't really migrate like that.
Right.
It's a totally different species. So that's why when you have states like Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, Nevada, man, if you cut a four-lane freeway through a traditional mule deer migration corridor or antelope, that herd's going to struggle.
Oh,
and not
yeah.
just struggle, but in all likelihood, will just peter away.
Right. They definitely will. So it's really neat to see a lot of these projects or programs kind of getting a lot more highlighted across Nevada and across other states as well, because they are going to be needed. If you've never seen one, just I-80 going towards Elko.
There's some on 95.
Yep. They're really cool. Actually, I had the privilege once of driving along, going out to the Elko area for a meeting, and came across it, and there's a big old group of mule deer
going
right
across
on the top of it.
Yeah.
Right on, it was just the coolest thing, cruising along. And then there's a few underpasses, which are not just big game. And they put trail cameras on these things to see what's using it. And they've got desert tortoises cruising across those things. They got foxes. I mean, you name it.
I don't know about cruising with the tortoise, Dave.
Well, he's meandering.
Inching along.
Yeah, he's meandering about.
Yeah.
So, but it's just really cool to see everything's using those.
Right.
It's a benefit. So
now, where do those land in the cost level? I'm assuming something like that, an overpass or an underpass for a migration corridor, that's got to be near the top of the list as far as like a rehabilitation or a modification program.
For cost?
For cost, yeah.
Well, a vegetated overpass, what I mean by that is it's an overpass that has a foot or two or so of
soil.
Of soil,
yeah.
And it's made to look like a mountain. made right. to look like actual habitat. Those can run anywhere from like $2 to $10 million to build.
And where's the funding come from?
So some of that can be funded through like road taxes and stuff because it's a collaboration of funds generally. You'll have some wildlife funds in there, some federal road funds that can kind of be bled into there. You'll have nonprofits donating to things like that. Like, you know, you may have like NBU or Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, something like that kind of put into it. A lot of those things take quite a few years to get the planning and the funding all situated to get done. And then there's a lot of analysis on where's the best place to put it. You just don't drive along. Yeah, this looks like a cool place.
This would be easy.
There's a lot of.
Okay, well, let's get more into the state of Nevada unique conservation hurdles that face us when we come back on Nevada Backcountry. Thanks for hanging in there over the break, and thanks to Shooting Performance Institute. Most of the course dates are up. I know Jim started pushing the long-range course. So, hey, if you think you're due for a tag this year, you've got your new Howa Superlight, sign up for one of Jim's courses. Make sure you get out, figure out what ammo works, and figure out your effective ethical range. So we talked a little bit about migration corridors, stuff like that, but as far as these issues, identifying them, determining what needs to be addressed. How does that happen at the state level, Dave?
Well, so first, I mean, Nevada has actively addressing all of these wildlife conservation challenges through a combination of like state level initiatives and collaboration with federal agencies and local communities and stuff. A lot of the priorities, because you're asking like, how does this stuff get prioritized?
Right.
Through those, they'll create plans or programs.
Okay.
And those are basically the initiatives, the state level initiatives. And there are quite a few. The main one is what's called the Nevada SWAP, the Nevada Wildlife Action Plan. So these have to be done every 5 years. They're federally mandated in order to receive federal funding. And this particular plan is hundreds of pages long, and it covers everything that the Department of Wildlife is responsible for managing, anywhere from big game, small game, habitat, recreational conservation, you know, conservation education. It covers everything. That's the biggest plan.
So when you say you have to do these things to get federal funding,
correct?
Does the federal government dictate these will be addressed, or does the state say?
No, it is the Nevada state plan on how to manage wildlife and the habitat. Since Nevada is so federally owned, Bureau of Land Management gets this like comment period on it, and collaborators help create this plan with the Department of Wildlife being the primary author. It's our state species, it's our priority species, our priority habitats, and how we're going to go about managing them for the next period of time before the plan needs to be rewritten again.
Maybe not necessarily like a high degree of autonomy, but you at least have Nevada has the ball and can run with it.
Correct.
And push what they want to push.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Within reason. Then there's the sage grouse plan and the conservation plan for sage grouse. There's the desert tortoise recovery programs that are going on. Primarily, that's obviously down south. The invasive species management program. There's the wildlife corridor, like we were just talking about, and road mortality prevention program. There's the public involvement, like education and conservation plan. So there's a bunch of different plans that kind of bleed into each other and help guide the department in how to go about certain projects.
Can we talk about the sage grouse for a minute?
Yeah.
And the reason I want to talk about the sage grouse, you mentioned that that's kind of butting up against the pinyon jay?
The pinyon jays.
So how do you determine a priority there? And you made mention of the pinyon jay being kind of a federal issue.
It's becoming. Yeah, it's becoming something that's being more highlighted because of the quick decline in that particular species.
So how do you balance the two when you have two things that are, you know, you said the pinyon jay is kind of popping up on the federal radar. The sage grouse is listed.
It's on the radar.
So how do you balance those, or is there a balance to be found?
finding a balance with something like that is one of them becomes more highlighted, being the pinion jay. As surveys start happening a lot more for the pinion jays, finding out where those habitats are, where their nesting habitats are, what pinion junipers are more active than others. As you find, say, you find a very active pinion jay location, and you know there are sage grouse in the periphery of it. Generally, they'll eliminate all the pinion juniper to create more sage grouse habitat. But if you have an area where you have high activity of a pinion jay nesting colony, then that would become a priority to not damage or affect that breeding habitat for okay. the pinion jays. And then you would focus your efforts in a different location, possibly for the sage grouse, and leave that area. You know, you've already got a species there that is already a high priority species. It's already active there. It's doing well. And that one would take priority in that particular area.
And to draw a connection to like hunting and hunters, because I know some people listening are going to be sitting there going, man, I don't give a flying you know what about the pinion jay. I always think of like that PJ habitat as being really good for mule deer.
Yeah.
And for herds of elk, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yeah.
So I look at anything that benefits a pinion jay as benefiting mule deer and elk as well.
Oh, yeah.
And I like sage grouse. I know some people listening are going, have you ever eaten one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
it's
look.
It's a very cool bird on the landscape. They're
absolutely
really cool.
I see the benefit of focusing on like a pinion jay for the benefit to the elk, to the mule deer, to the other animals that use that habitat, versus a sage grouse that needs a very specific type of habitat that probably isn't conducive to other big game species.
To some degree, I mean, you're going to, when you start single focus species that you're trying to enhance or promote or, you know, expand their habitats, you're always going to benefit other species, but you're also going to affect negatively another group of species. So there's right. always a give and take when you start doing single species focus.
How far away, and this is just a Dave Catalano opinion, how far away do you think we are from just not being able to hunt sage grouse?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, over the years, we've noticed that the hunting has decreased, seasons have shortened, areas have been closed off. I don't know. That's a tough one. It's a real hit or miss thing right now.
Would a decade be strong? If I said in a decade, like my kids aren't going to hunt sage grouse in a decade.
That's kind of a flip of the coin. It just depends on, there are multi-state group that's dealing with sage grouse.
Right.
Habitat, sage grouse expansion. It's a real touchy situation. Nevada's sage grouse in some areas are doing really well. In other areas, not so well. That's a tough one. But there is a lot of money and a lot of time being spent on sage grouse.
If I snapped my fingers, I'm going to keep throwing these at you.
Go for it.
If I snapped my fingers right now and feral horses were gone.
Oh, you'd see a lot of critters would probably benefit from that.
You know, because for years.
Well, maybe not gone, just down to a manageable level.
I snap my fingers and there's 10,000 remaining. Would my kids still be able to hunt sage grouse?
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah, probably.
Has that big of an impact?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I got for you on hypotheticals.
On hypotheticals.
If I snap my fingers. When is my growth spurt going to kick in?
Oh, that's a tough one. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so that's all I wanted to pin you down on sage grouse stuff. And I know that's kind of a touchy subject, but it always kind of intrigued me that we're kind of willing to let this one species go by the wayside for something like a feral horse. And I like sage grouse. I think they're cool. They always make me feel confident behind a shotgun because it's like hitting a basketball with wings.
Right. They're just such a cool animal on the landscape when you do see a group of them.
Oh, during mating
there,
season?
On a lek. Yep. I mean, it is the coolest thing to watch. You know, there's a lot of challenges, especially for the state of Nevada, where the state agencies don't have a say in the feral horse issue.
Right.
That's a federal thing. And not that the federal agencies aren't doing anything. I'm sure their hands are tied. I guarantee you that the person or persons involved or in charge of feral horse management in the state of Nevada aren't going to work every day going, man, I wonder what I can do to like get like 500 emails that are just so mad at me.
Yeah.
They want the situation. They really would like to see a resolution to the situation, but even their hands are tied.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things. Like it's just this nasty sore that just keeps growing and itching.
And people keep suing and tying it up. I mean,
that is one of our biggest issues. And then when you were talking about priorities, we'll go back to priorities.
Yes.
Real quick,
There
may be priorities on the books to do habitat restoration work in certain areas or negotiate mitigations for certain projects that are going on. That can get all thrown to the wolves at any point when we have wildfires, like the one we had there, the Davis Wild, the ones we've had out in Elko and Winnemucca. Once there's a wildfire, things pivot because you've got to get on that recovery mode pretty darn quick because you need to evaluate it. You need to start determining your seed mixes and you need to start getting out there and getting on top of the recovery, the habitat recovery project before the invasives come in. Because once those kick in, it's insanely difficult to then convert it back into our natural
good
vegetation.
Habitat.
Good wildlife habitat.
That's what Chris, in fact, the show I re-aired last weekend, Chris brought that up where I never realized there's that lag period with that stuff where you've got to put in like an herbicide.
Correct.
For a year or two before you even start the reseeding. So it's not like I'll use the snap your fingers thing again,
right.
But it's not like snap your fingers, throw out some Indian rice grass seed, bada bing, bada boom, you're good to go.
Yeah, walk away and you're fine in 3 years. No, it's got to be monitored. So, I mean, there are a great deal of projects going on out there. One of the big issues that seems to be popping its head up as well is all the renewable stuff that's going on. And that's been a pretty big roadblock when it comes to trying to manage good wildlife habitat and specific species that are occupying these areas where solar complexes are coming in or geothermal or, you know, wind energy, whatever it might be. I mean, that takes up an enormous amount of time.
Time is one thing we don't have. We're going to go to break, but when we come back, there's three things I want to ask you about. Wolves, renewable energy, and then you talked about pivoting and putting funding into these other things. I wanted to talk about some of the funding stuff. Don't go anywhere. It's all coming up on Nevada Backcountry. Thanks for joining us again on Nevada Backcountry, only on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Thank you to Battleborn Tree Service for sponsoring the show. For hunters, by hunters. If you've still got some lingering storm damage, get in touch with Mike and the crew at Battleborn Tree Service. Right off the bat, let's go funding, because you mentioned like all this stuff could just get tossed out the window if there's a fire and you've got a... So where I'm going with that is there a reallocation of funds process, or does funding kind of exist in a silo? Like, hey, this is earmarked for this. It could never be used for anything else. It's for this only.
Yeah, there's definitely funding that is set up like that. Once you acquire that funding, it is specifically for a specific project. There are stipulations to certain funding sources. You have other funding sources that are more of like a blanket funding. And if the project doesn't get done or completed in a certain time, you can extend that funding. Going through projects, you need to understand what funding sources you have for that project so that you spend it effectively.
So let's say there is a giant fire and all of a sudden now we've got to put a bunch of money into herbicides and seeding and all that. Is there a savings account? How does this stuff get addressed?
There is some funding that is from license sales and game management and...
And that can be allocated to fire stuff.
It's in a pot that then can be used for projects.
Okay.
And some of those funds can then be reallocated based on emergency priority situations like that, like heritage funds or game management funds. There's a few pots that can be pulled from. there's always like a contingency amount in there for those particular situations, you know, where something does come up and you're like, hey, man, we need 12 pallets of a seed mix for this particular range.
You mentioned things coming up.
Right.
And you used the phrase something about thrown to the wolves.
You
don't have to say anything. I'm going to throw it out there. This is my opinion based on me being out in the woods pretty regularly and having seen wolves with my own eyes in the state of Nevada. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, I can be an idiot, but they were wolves. They weren't coyotes. They were wolves. Wolves coming onto the landscape in Nevada, is there going to be a certain level of attention directed towards that from a management aspect, or is it now kind of at that point, like, let's just wait and see?
That's a really good question because I don't really have the answer. I'm sure once...
You better come up with
you
one.
You better come up with it, man. You know, once they are confirmed to be in the state and that there is a population that is spending a significant amount of its yearly time
not
here.
Just pass-throughs,
not just
pass-throughs,
yeah, not just coming in, going back up into Idaho, Oregon, wherever they might be. That is not something that's just going to be like, eh, let's just kick back and watch what happens. Just don't see that happening whatsoever. There's that, I was just reading about it. Montana, I think it was Montana that it is tearing the daylights out of these ranchers' calves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's been going on. Those packs up there just wreak havoc.
Oh, yeah.
On that. Yeah.
There was one rancher's already lost like 27 calves this year.
Right.
They just go in there and then they're just, they kill them and then they leave them lay and then they go whack another one. So anyway, so it's, you know, I don't know how I got off on that one.
I don't know, but.
That's a situation where you've got like, that's like, okay, something's
got
to get
we've
done.
We've got issues. You know, yeah.
Will Nevada get to that point? I don't see it in Nevada getting to that point.
And part of that is because we just don't have the habitat to sustain. I can think of maybe 4 or 5 ranges off the top of my head that I would say, okay, it's got the dense timber. It's got this, you know, check all the boxes. There's enough wildlife there, like maybe could sustain a pack, but we just haven't gotten to that point.
Yeah, I mean, they really love the elk and they love the deer. We've got a couple areas in the state that have some pretty good elk populations.
That would, know, yeah. That,
yeah, could probably deal with a small pack. You know, that stuff hasn't been confirmed yet. So, but there would definitely be. It's
okay.
Floating around there. It's conversation on a regular basis. Moving beyond conversation. Remains to be seen.
Renewable energy in the state of Nevada.
Yeah.
Is there money being set aside to deal with some of the fallout from this? Because you and I have talked before on the show as far as like the impact this stuff is going to have. What's the state doing about that from a conservation aspect?
When you have an entity comes in and wants to put in, hypothetical here, a solar complex,
yeah,
you know, take up 10,000 acres of solar. All of that land is surveyed. It's all determined through past records of what's using that particular land. And then what can be requested is what's called mitigation funds. That's where you basically put a value on destruction of wildlife habitat. So there's a particular project out there now that's going possibility of eliminating several burrowing owl habitats. Burrowing owls are very specific. That has the soils have to be a certain type. It has to be certain grades, all kinds of stuff. Well, this project will come in and just completely bulldoze these three burrowing
southern
owl
part
habitat.
Of the state or northern part
northern.
Of the state?
Northern. There's a value to that. There's a value to those animals, you know, burrows. And that's determined, and then they put that into a fund, and then that money can be used to either help the burrowing owls or help another species out that needs it.
I mean, how do you put those funds to use, and how do you put a value on something like that? Because you can't just create new habitat.
Yeah, you can't go into like Kelly Blue Book or something.
Yeah,
and
well,
type
this is yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah,
it really comes down to. So you see that particular habitat, like, okay, they're going to destroy that, but we could use some new habitat for XYZ species over here, and this project's going to run X amount of dollars. That becomes kind of the request. It can be.
Okay.
It can be kind of something like that. You know, you're going to destroy this habitat, and we need more habitat of this over here, and that project's going to be X amount of bucks, and have that exchange.
Man, that sucks. Just on a sidebar real quick. That sucks. I like burrowing owls.
I love burrowing owls.
Those ones we found out there when we were on your antelope hunt.
That was so cool.
I think they're cool. My brother and I were just talking about this. I think burrowing owls are super cool. That sucks that we're going to lose.
Yeah.
So, or potentially could.
It potentially could. There are, well, there's a lot of research out there that shows how to build burrowing owl habitat.
You just got to find the right soil.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
You just need to find the proper soil that allows them to burrow. It's not something like you're not going to just dump a bunch of soft soils out there on a mound and throw seeds on there, and then they're going to show up tomorrow and they're going to start burrowing. It could take years before they address that particular piece of land and utilize it. Or they may never utilize it at all. It's a real crapshoot.
What do you do? Do you trap them and relocate? Or
you can, but you know, if you don't have something established for them, you could trap them and take them to an artificial
man-made
burrowing system,
right?
And say, here, you guys go, get in there, and they're gonna fly off. It's tough when you're talking about critters that can fly.
Yes,
it's kind of like folks sit there and go like, well, yeah, we're building this new housing complex. Why don't you just dart the deer and move them somewhere else? Well, they have like a internal GPS system. Like they know where they need to be certain times of the year. And you move them somewhere else, they're going to come back.
I use that example of that black bear trapped in, I think it was Tennessee when we're talking about bears. That black bear made its way across like two states. It was some ungodly, like 1,000+ miles, and went right back to the campground it was trapped in.
Well, and that happens here is when they have a problem bear and they trank it and do their thing and then they relocate it somewhere. A week later, it's back. You know, because it's like, oh, yeah, that's tag number 44444. He's back.
They know where they want to be.
They know where, exactly. Yeah. They're like, no.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a terrible hangover. What the hell happened? I got to go home.
Yeah. So renewable can be a tough pill, you know, depending on the size of the project, location of the project, and how it is affecting wildlife in general.
All right. Well, let's save some time. We'll go to break right now. Thank you to Truck Envy for sponsoring the show. When we come back, let's talk about the ATV, UTV, off-road usage, and some other, I'll call them issues, facing conservation.
Yep.
Hey, final segment of Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Thank you all sincerely for taking time out of your Sunday to listen to the show. And don't forget, if you miss a segment or you miss an entire episode, if you're an Apple Podcast user, just search for Nevada Backcountry. And you can always go to the website 991fmtalk.com. Past episodes are all listed there. You just click on the podcast tab. I think we got enough time here. This is a big topic. Let's try to break it off in bite-sized chunks. ATV usage, UTV usage, damage on land in the state of Nevada. Where do you want to start with this, Dave?
You know, there's a lot of area. I mean, Nevada's got so many roads that you can just get lost on. Department of Wildlife has designated UTV areas. They've got designated roads. BLM's got those maps that you can purchase. They're all Onyx, you know, you get on there, the ride version of Onyx Hunt, it's Onyx Ride or something, which show you all the designated spots that you can use and stay off of some of the critical wildlife habitats, especially in areas like we were talking earlier, burn areas or areas that have been chained for rehabilitation and planted. You got all these new plantings and seedlings and sprays and all this other stuff. Folks just have such a hard time staying on the road.
I'm going to say something, and I am not a Puritan by any stretch of the imagination. Don't crucify me, people. I'm going to say hunters are some of the biggest offenders when it comes to this stuff. If it's the guy in the $50,000 souped up razor and they've got the horn, generally that guy is like, this is my hobby. And I know all the trails, I've got the maps, like that's what he's into. He's not the guy ripping down through a stand of Quakies. And I hate to say that. That's the God's honest truth as far as just my Henry Evans take on it. Hunters are some of the worst offenders when it comes to breaking new trail, creating new roads, going through critical bedding habitat, stuff like
right.
that.
And you are right. The largest offender are hunters. I'd say the next step beyond that are shed hunters.
Oh, I would say shed hunters are even worse. Yeah. But I still see it during hunting season.
Yeah, oh yeah. Every year I see it. People too lazy to actually hunt and get off their UTV or out of their UTV, and they take the machine straight up a mountain ridge so they can get to the top so they can glass. There are some pretty massive fines when you are caught, and other recreationalists and hunters, everyone has a camera. Everyone's got a iPhone with
usually this, attached to a spotting scope.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are a lot of folks that do get busted. They may go home from their hunt and they're like all hunky dory, like, "Yeah, man, this is great. Had a great time." And then all of a sudden they get a letter or they get a phone call and they deny, but there's Joe Schmo or Sally Sue took a video of them crashing through sagebrush. Next thing you know, you're writing a nice fat check.
I put hunters on a pedestal, Western hunters on a pedestal, as far as we're the last true stewards of the land. We are the ones most connected to it, most dependent on it for our way of life. And I don't know how you get through to the guy smashing a suitcase of Keystone Light and ripping through, like you said, sagebrush or whatever. I don't know where that disconnect is, because I always look at myself as like, I'm going to take better care of this than the city slicker who maybe does a 1 week backpacking trip every year.
Yeah.
It behooves me, my lifestyle, my interests, to take care of this stuff and not be the jackass out here wrecking it. So then I can go to the jackasses that wreck it and say, look, this is what we do. We take care of this stuff because we are so enmeshed with it as part of our way of life.
Yeah.
So that may all sound like philosophical grandstanding. I mean, I don't know how we get through to other hunters like, look, dude, man, that sucks. Your dad's 80 years old and he's got this elk tag or whatever. And I know you really want to get him a bull. Don't take the friggin' side by side down that canyon. There's no roads down there. Just don't do it.
That is probably one of the bigger issues. I mean, these UTVs and ATVs have been a blessing in relation to allowing us not to destroy these insanely expensive trucks we all seem to own. You know, it's also been a double-edged sword because now they've gotten so... My UTV has got lockers. I could climb a tree with that thing.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing stops it. So there's a lot of damage going on, a lot of new roads. But it's not only that. One of the biggest issues now is that these animals, elk, deer, antelope, everything, don't have a break.
Come Monday morning, I'm going to have an inbox full of Henry hates UTVs and go to hell. So anyway, thank you for tying it. I've already got a bumper sticker thought out. So thank you for tying it back into conservation. But that's really the key point, is how much it affects the wildlife and how much more work then is required to make sure these herds are sustainable year after year after year.
Yeah, exactly. Because a lot of folks just think, well, our deer herds are down because of predators and feral horses. Yes, they are down because of those things. There's no doubt about it. There is also another variable in there, and that is folks out and about recreating out with their UTVs and such year round and pushing animals. So then they don't breed, or their young, don't survive because they're being pushed from canyon to canyon to canyon. I mean, it may be a very small amount, but when you have herds that are decreasing at the rate they are right now, any small amount is a big loss.
And I would argue it's not a small, I think of some units, especially in that, I'll use like the sixes, the big six. Some units in there where they're so crisscrossed with roads.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the elk herds are. And man, as I sit here, I went out yesterday to look at sheep and everything. So look, I get it. I'm out off season checking out areas and stuff on foot. I try to minimize my impact as much as possible. I get wanting to see wildlife off season, but some of these units, even if you're staying on the road, just ripping around on a UTV puts a ton of stress on the herd. So yeah, okay, maybe macro level, you could call it small. I think it has a big impact on those, especially the elk herds in some of these areas.
Oh, definitely. I've been out in June and July. There have been times in some areas where I've seen 5, 6, 7, 8 other people out there ripping around on their
side
UTV,
by sides.
And they're doing the same thing I'm doing. They're just recreating, having a good time. But there is that stress factor.
Yes.
That really can put an impact on.
Is there a pot of funding that goes into, like, the unit that our friend Pat had his sheep tag in?
Right.
Right. And big winter, roads washed out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is there funding to rehabilitate those roads so that new roads aren't cut?
Well, certain roads out there are managed by the Bureau of Land Management, and they'll come in, they'll fix the road. If you have a nasty washout, like out where
Slum Gully,
there, where it's just a 5-foot deep trench that's 4 feet wide and takes up half the road and you're not getting past it, they know that it's there. They know that it needs to be addressed. It might be a few years before they can get to
right.
it. I mean, there's that's
and they're,
not
they're
the
generally
only road.
Not in like easy to access areas.
That particular one, that's Slum Gully in there. That is brutal road.
You got to really want to get out there to.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm sure that's pretty far down the.
Yeah.
But so that would be like a BLM funding thing.
That's all up to them. That's their funding and their program on some of those roads, maintaining some of those roads. The Department of Wildlife doesn't. There is no road maintenance program because that's not that's not
part of your purview.
Yeah, it's not the purview. So that's generally, if you see something really wrecked and mashed up, take photos of it and send it into the BLM with coordinates saying, hey, this is completely wrenched.
Man, now I'm depressed. No, I'm not depressed. I had a great night last night at the Muley Foundation banquet. Thanks to all the radio station listeners that support that event, that have made it what it is today. KKFT 99.1, my dad and I have been involved with, since day one when it was over at the Elks Lodge. Thank you to all of you that support that foundation, that were there last night. Hopefully I made a bunch of new friends. Don't go anywhere. Tom Gresham's Gun Talk is coming up next.